Good evening. This is Heartstock Radio. I'm Carol Murphy, your host. Thank you so much for being here. You can reach us by email at heartstockradio@gmail.com. We're also on Facebook. Please find us there. And don't forget to leave us a message. We'd love to hear from you, especially if you know of somebody that would like to be our guest, or maybe you would like to be our guest. This evening's program, we have Sarah Andrews with us. She's the founder of Bumble Root Foods. In just a moment, Sarah will be back to tell you all about Bumble Root and her adventures in life. It's going to be fun. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back. Hi, this is Heartstock Radio. Thank you so much for listening. Our guest this evening is Sarah Andrews. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, how are you?
We're fantastic. Are you in Missoula by chance?
I'm actually in Big Fork.
Okay, well, here in Butte, it is an absolutely perfectly fall day. The weather is gorgeous. We're kind of having an Indian summer here. Is it nice there?
Oh, it's just gorgeous. Yeah. Bright blue skies and all of the changing colors and changing marches. And it's just beautiful.
We're so lucky to live in Montana.
Oh, definitely. I can't imagine living anywhere else now.
Me too. Every day I pinch myself. Tell us a little bit about Bumble Root to start out. And then we're going to talk about you and how you got involved with Bumble Root.
Sure. So Bumble Root is a food company, and we are focusing on creating food products that feature ingredients that support biodiversity and regenerative agriculture. So when I say that, what I mean is right now, when you look at most packaged food products, 80% of the calories come from corn, wheat, soy, and sugar. And that means we have a lot of land that is just, it's growing the same things. And a lot of times from a very conventional standpoint with pesticides, synthetic fertilizers, and we've been hurting our soil by growing food in that way. And so I created Bumble Root first to start focusing on ingredients that just didn't have big markets, but had a real nutritional punch, but were also good for the planet. So we started with a hydration drink mix, which features baobab fruit from the baobab tree in Africa, which is a huge tree that supports its own ecosystem of other plants and animals and pollinators. And the fruit that grows on it is very nutritionally dense. And by providing value to that fruit, it protects that tree from being cut down. And most of these trees are hundreds to thousands of years old. So those are the types of stories we want to tell. We are now expanding into Montana products, and we'll be featuring farmers and ranchers who are practicing regenerative practices that are improving the health of the soil. So we'll be launching a meat snack focusing on farmers practicing regenerative grazing practices, really regenerating and making healthier soil. We're also working on a vegan lentil mushroom jerky to tell the story of our great organic lentil farmers in Montana, and a sourdough bread kit that will feature some great organic wheat from Montana and Camu as well, and will come with a dehydrated starter so people can really experience that experience of making their own bread. We really want to connect people through their food, through education of better farming and harvesting, and also just being able to with their own hands really feel that connection.
So tell us a little bit about your own personal story and what set you on this path.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Montana and was surrounded by agriculture, but wasn't directly involved with it. My grandparents had been ranchers, but my parents were teachers. So it wasn't part of my day-to-day life. But I think just being here, you absorb the importance of agriculture and don't realize how much you learn just being around it. And then I went to university in the Midwest, and after college ended up working for Max Baucus in DC. And I grew up in Miles City. And since I was from a rural area, they immediately put me on agricultural issues. And I received a very quick introduction to U.S. farm policy, as well as the other areas that fall under that. For example, the child nutrition bill, the food lunch program, the things that fall under the agriculture committee. And Max was also chairman of the finance committee at the time. And that meant I got to work on international trade issues and really focus on the agriculture provisions of those, which meant that we got to travel to different countries to learn how trade agreements would affect those countries, and really became interested in small farmers around the world and the impact that the global food system has on their livelihoods and the sustainability and the type of agriculture practices that they were utilizing. And then after that, I went to business school, worked in the business world for a number of years in Chicago, and really just wanted to get back to the roots, to really get on the ground somewhere and understand what was going on. So I ended up moving to Zimbabwe after the collapse of commercial farming there, and worked with the agriculture industry. And it was during that time there that I decided to start Bumble Root and create a food company that reflected the values I wanted to see in the food system, and try to change the food system by providing options for consumers to purchase products that would vote for a better food system.
So when you went to Zimbabwe, was that with an NGO?
It was. I helped start an office there for an NGO called TechnoServe. TechnoServe is based out of Washington, D.C., and their philosophy is private sector solutions to poverty. So what they like to do is to create work in developing countries and help grow an industry that entrepreneurs can thrive under. And so usually that's agriculture and tourism. And I worked on both of those industries, but mostly agriculture. And this was right after there had been land reform in Zimbabwe. And Zimbabwe had been the breadbasket of Africa, really kind of another Montana. Area-wise, it's the same way as Montana, and would be similar to Montana or California in terms of growing a good chunk of the food for Africa and for Europe. There were large staple crop farms, so the maize and wheat and soy, but also a lot of fruits and vegetables, a lot of livestock, flowers, just had very fertile land. And people knew for a long time land reform needed to happen. Most of the good land was held by white farmers who had been given land during the colonization process. And everyone agreed that land reform needed to happen, that there needed to be a more equal distribution of land. But unfortunately, it happened in a very violent way. And it meant that really good land was left fallow, and land that was left for small farmers to farm that wasn't caught up in sort of the legal turmoil following this land reform was very subpar. So when I was there, we were really working to try to create market mechanisms to help integrate those small farmers into a broader market and supply the processors there, be able to buy inputs with loans, be connected to extension services to learn practices to increase their yields and the quality of their soil and nutrition of their food. And so that's what I was working on when I was there. And I realized during a lot of that, the work we were doing, that a lot of the development work being done around the world and the work we were doing was very thoughtful, but a lot of the kind of prescriptions coming down from the aid agencies at the time, and this has luckily changed a lot in the last few years, we're really trying to promote a system that we use in the U.S. that works on tens of thousands of acres, but doesn't work on 1 to 2 acres. And that became discouraging because we were wanting small farmers to follow the same practice. A farmer in Montana, it would need 5,000 acres to do in terms of the type of fertilizers and pesticides and labor that they would have to do. And unfortunately, at that scale, it's very risky for the small farmer. And it just seemed like there was a better way to promote products that were wild, that were more cash crops that provided more of an income with less inputs. And so the first product we created was to support the baobab ecosystem. And one of the reasons we really loved it, aside from it just being an amazing tree and ecosystem, is that when the fruit is ripe, it falls to the ground and harvesters can go collect it and doesn't require, other than time, does not require an investment of inputs on there. And so then they can use that cash they get to buy seeds, to buy inputs for their other crops, to purchase petrol for their well, to pay for school fees. But it gave them some cash that otherwise they have to wait for a full growing season to have. So that was one of the reasons we really focused on that, and to try to create some elements of earning cash outside just growing a staple crop on 1 to 2 acres.
How long were you there total?
I was there a year and then would go back and forth. And we work with an incredible supply chain there. And so I love to go back and visit and stay in touch with our suppliers and harvesters. And unfortunately, I haven't been back in a few years, but hoping to make it back this spring.
Can you give us some maybe stories of what life was like there? It sounds like it was very chaotic, but maybe not as much now.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I think when you read about situations happening in the news, they seem more chaotic than when you're actually there at that time, because when you're there at a certain moment of time, you're just present and you deal with what's in front of you. And as humans, I think we're just natural problem solvers. So it doesn't seem so chaotic when you're in it. You're just dealing with it. So when I first got there, there had been 1,000,000,000% inflation. Sure. And this meant that people were going to the grocery store with shopping carts full of cash to get a loaf of bread. And the kids who grew up in that time are amazing at math now, because every day, every hour of the day, the currency exchange was changing. And so what a loaf of bread was worth in the morning was different at noon, was different at night. So people were able to do math in their heads very well. So if you want to hire mathematicians, hire children from, or adults from Zimbabwe who grew up during that time. But when I arrived, they have just switched to use the US dollar and the South African rand. So things were starting to just stabilize. It stabilized very quickly after that in terms of inflation. Other things took longer. But it was really interesting when I first arrived there. When you would walk into the, I think grocery stores can just give you so much information about the state that a community is in. And when I first arrived at the grocery store, you could get some local greens, you could get vegetable oil, ramen noodles. It seems that no matter, I've lived on a lot of different continents and a lot of different countries, it seems like no matter what the situation, you can find ramen noodles, which is good, and rice. And so we had to be very creative with making meals, and I lived in a place with a shared kitchen at the time, and then we moved into a cottage in our office, and we just had to be very creative. And working in the agriculture industry, sometimes people would give us a chicken, or we'd get more variety, or we'd make friends with people who had gardens, and we could get, you know, some tomatoes and some eggs and some other things. But just within a year after that, after the currency had been stabilized, by the time I left a year later, there was couscous, there were mini veggies, a sushi bar had come to town. It was really amazing how quickly stabilization changed the grocery store shelves. And all of a sudden, there you could get pretty much anything you wanted. And that only took a year. So it's really amazing how quickly things can change in an economy. And part of that was stabilization. Part of it might have been some things that might not be as activities that might not have been as above board that were bringing cash into the economy. But for various reasons, just watching that economy change in 1 year was really amazing. And, you know, and it had been there before too, hearing stories of people who grew up in Zimbabwe. You know, it had been very bright, vibrant and dynamic and wealthy, and not wealthy for everyone, but wealthy as a Southern African country. But to then have been there kind of during one of its darkest times and see that grow was really, really an experience.
And what about now? Do you think that things have stabilized and that the land redistribution was a success for the country?
on land distribution? Not yet. There's still a long way to go. And unfortunately, at that time, the assets that were on the big farms and ranches, like the irrigation systems, the tractors, just the different improvements that have been made to the land, those had been kind of stolen, sold off in South Africa. And so it's going to take a long time to rebuild the agriculture sector in that way. But it's interesting when certain elements of a system aren't there, other systems then rise to meet it. So I found more entrepreneurs in Zimbabwe than probably anywhere I had lived at the time I was living there. The government wasn't functioning well. There wasn't a surplus of food by any means. And people rose up to meet that challenges and to find the solutions to meet those. So that's one thing I've always been so impressed with by Zimbabweans, is just their ability to fill to meet the needs that are there and find ways to get there. And I don't think, you know, the situation is completely out of the woods yet. It's still not back to the economic situation it was in the 80s or 90s, but I think there's a lot of hope. The country has great land. There are great people, hardworking people, and so it'll get there. Now there is a new government in place, and people have a lot of hope that it's going in the right direction. Mm. And for anyone who wants to visit there, I highly recommend it. I feel safe when I'm there. And it's one of the most, other than, you know, Montana, we're used to wildlife and being able to go out and access wild lands and public lands. And one thing that Zimbabwe has done probably better than almost any other African country is really protect their public lands. And there are so many amazing places to go to, still so much wildlife. It's one of the only countries I know of that you can do safari on foot, which can be kind of scary. I prefer horseback, but, you can go on a hike and run into an elephant, and there aren't many places that are still that wild. And a lot of other African countries, it feels, when you go on safari, it feels sort of more like you're within a game park, and it's enclosed area. It's still always amazing, but within Zimbabwe, it still has that feeling of Montana, those wide open spaces of not knowing what you'll see and what will be there.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. So we're about halfway through, so we're going to take a quick music break, and we will be right back to hear more about Bumble Root Foods and Sarah. Heartstock Radio, thank you so much for being with us. Our guest this evening is Sarah Andrews, and Sarah is sharing her story, how she, as a founder, created Bumble Root Foods and her entrepreneurial journey to create these products. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
So tell us a little bit about the baobab. It sounds like that in and of itself, getting it over here to the U.S., you import it? Is that the case?
We do. So the process on the harvesting and how that works is when the baobab is the only fruit that I'm aware of. If anyone knows of another one, we'd love to hear, because we haven't found another one that does this. But it's the only fruit that we know of that dries within its shell. So when you open the fruit and it's sort of this big coconut looking thing, the pulp is already dry inside, and it sits around a seed. So when you're there, you kind of take it out and eat it like a candy and suck on it. And then if you can get the seed soft enough, you can actually chew that. So the process is when the fruit is ripe, it actually drops to the ground because these trees are huge. They'd be very difficult to climb. They're so big that like houses have been built in them. There are pictures of bars built within the baobab trees. And so when the fruit is ripe, it drops to the ground and the harvesters pick it up, and they have favorite trees. So within a community, they'll know the trees that are the sweetest, and usually the sweetest is going to have some of the best nutritional qualities. And these trees have a very sacred place in these communities too. They're places that they gather to hold ceremonies. They're known as the tree of life, and they form the center of a lot of community functions and history and stories. And so when they're collected, they get brought to a collection point. The harvesters then try to have as many pieces of the process done there to keep as much of the value and the money in the communities as possible. So there, the fruit gets brushed off. It's a little fuzzy, and that helps get any bacteria off that might be on it. And then they crack it open, and it gets put through a machine that takes the seeds out. And then that pulp gets sent to Harare, to the main city in Zimbabwe, where it gets ground up. There are pectins that provide some great dietary benefits. And those get ground up so they don't just float around in the product. So it gets ground up a little bit more from Zimbabwe, goes through to South Africa where it gets put through a sieve, and then gets shipped to the United States. And then for our products, when we first looked at making a drink, we looked at creating a bottled drink, but it seemed really silly to create a drink where we just added water back into something that was a powder already. And we realized that there were a lot of powdered drinks out there, but they were very specific, focused on some sort of nutritional aspect. And so we wanted to create something different. And we found a great source of dehydrated coconut water, and the baobab flavor and the coconut water flavor pair really, really well together. And the baobab already has natural electrolyte qualities. And so with the baobab, the potassium and the coconut water and the other electrolytes and the baobab together, they create a hydration drink. And then we added real dried fruits and herbs to it to create the flavor. And it's sweetened with monk fruit and stevia. We didn't want to add any additional sugar. So it's all real ingredients and put together in a pouch. We have both individual pouches that people can use and add to their water bottle, or a bulk bag so they can take a spoonful and add it to their drink and use it daily. And the drinks also, many people use them as a replacement for a Gatorade type drink. Others use them for the base of their smoothies, and others just as a nutrition plus hydration drink throughout their day. So they have quite a few different uses. Yeah, and that's how that process works.
So I know that regenerative agriculture is very important to you and your company. How do your products, and the baobab in particular, fit into the scheme of regenerative agriculture?
Yes. And first, it might be helpful for me to explain a little bit about what regenerative means. I think
Definitely.
That's a new term for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So the word sustainable has been used for a long time in terms of sustainable food systems and doing things better than what would be called conventional agriculture, which is sort of the practice of synthetic inputs of fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, etc. And there can be a place for a certain amount of those, but I think general consensus is they've been used too much, and it has impacted our soils and the health of our lands and waters and air. Because of our focus on this type of farming, it's also led to monocultures of certain crops being grown in just very large quantities of acres, which impact biodiversity of the food that's being grown, but also the biodiversity of the insects, the microbiomes in the soil, the types of plants and animals that are living nearby. And then when we talk about sustainable really means keeping things out how they are. So this idea of regenerative is, can we actually improve the soil? Can we improve the biodiversity? Can we improve the water? Can we improve the air? And in doing that, what we know is that when we have more vibrant ecosystems and more biodiverse ecosystems, soil is able to sequester more carbon, which can be a solution to climate change. And then carbon and water have a direct correlation. So when more carbon is sequestered, that means more water is sequestered. And in Montana, where a large amount of our agriculture produce and products in the U.S. are grown, you know, drought has impacted us a lot in the last few decades. And a lot of farmers have recognized that going back to more traditional practices to regenerate their lands has been a way to actually have healthier land, to healthier soil, to sequester more water so that they're not impacted as much in drought years. And I've only been back in Montana now for about 3 years, and it's just been amazing to watch how many farmers have moved toward regenerative and organic practices, just finding that what they were doing on the land wasn't working. And so I sort of feel like we are the Silicon Valley of regenerative agriculture right now. And there's so much innovation to be had. A friend who is a regenerative farmer here in Montana texted me the other day something that's been really, I've been really thinking about. And he said, I don't know if we know how to farm yet. And I think just that mindset is so important. There are so many creative techniques that have been being tested out, and farmers are learning from each other. And I think we need to spread that knowledge between the farmers and ranchers even more. So when something works, that can be shared. When something doesn't work, that can be shared. And farming has really been working with nature. And that requires a lot of thoughtfulness and creativeness, because each part of land is different. Each ecosystem that each farmer is working with and is different. And so it isn't, you know, I think for the last 30, 40 years, we've thought that there is a way to have a one size fits all approach to agriculture. Mm-hmm. And what we're finding is that that doesn't work. And our soils and waters and air have been impacted because of that mindset. And so we're just so lucky in Montana to have so many thoughtful, creative people in agriculture who are really working to try to create ways to work with the land. And just kind of one addition to that is last year I went on a tour with Arrow, an amazing organization here in Montana, and they did a tour to follow Liz Carlisle's great book, Lentil Underground, where we visited some of the farms.
Sarah, lentils.
I
have to kind of let you know we've got about a minute left.
I
want to make sure that we have enough time that everybody finds out how they might reach you.
Yes. So we are on Facebook and Instagram, and have a website. It's bumblerootfoods.com. And then the Instagram and Facebook tags are at Bumbleroot Foods.
Gotcha. So in about a half a minute that we have left, this sounds like a very expensive endeavor. How did you fund your startup?
So it was self-funded at the beginning. We also did an Indiegogo campaign. And then we did our first equity funding through a site called Circle Up for equity crowdfunding. And we continue to fundraise. Unfortunately, food is an expensive industry, like you mentioned, and it's difficult to do packaged foods and grow organically from that. And so we have a group of amazing investors who have supported us through the process as we grow.
And moving forward, do you think you'll have exclusively Montana food-based products?
The next products in the pipeline for this next year are all Montana-based, but we'll see where we go. We mm-hmm. want to keep featuring international stories and just the best food ingredients and stories for the planet. And luckily, a lot of those are happening in Montana right now.
Nice. Well, thank you so much, Sarah, for being on Heartstock. And thank you, everyone, for listening. This is Carol Murphy, and we'll see you next week. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you, Carol.
Bye-bye.
Heartstock Radio is a production of KBMF 102.5 Butte America Radio. Hear our live programs every Friday at 5 p.m. Mountain Standard Time via live stream at butteamericaradio.org.